Muhammad Rasulullah by Abu al-Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 21, The Expedition of Tabuk. Some of the tribes still suffer from the delusion that the rise of Islam was a transient matter, like a burst of a cloud, whose tide would be stemming before long. It was not necessary to warn or even threaten such people before they utilize an opportunity to clench their fist at the Muslims. The expedition of Tabuk had the desired effect of such lukewarm tribes, such much in the same way as the conquest of Makkah had gone a long way in clearing away the clouds of opposition. This expedition against the Byzantine Empire, whose might and magnificence was well known to the Arabs, virtually meant that the Muslims were ready to fling down the gauntlet even to the greatest power in the world. In what esteem did the Arabs regard the Byzantinians, whom they called Romans, is well illustrated by the remark made by Abu Sufyan after he had seen Heraclius rendering honor to the Prophet's letter sent through envoy of the Prophet. He had heard Heraclius saying that he too expected a Prophet to be born. Abu Sufyan had then got up, as he related later on, rubbing his hands and saying that the affair of Ibn al-Qabsha, that is the Prophet, had become so great that the King of the Romans dreaded him. Abu Sufyan further says that he was then convinced that the Prophet would ultimately emerge victorious, and this is how Islam took root in his own heart. The Arabs could not dream of attacking the Byzantine Empire. They themselves feared Byzantine invasions, and rather did not rate themselves so high as to be coveted by a great power. When Muslims of Medina were attended with a grave danger, or their safety was imperiled, the most they could do or think of was to seek the aid of Ghassanid king, who was of East Syria under Caesar. What Umar said during the affair of Ayla, which took place in the beginning of 8th AH, throws significant light on the state of affairs in those days. He says that he had an Ansari friend with whom he had arranged that one of them should alternately remain in attendance upon the Prophet and inform the other about the incidents happening in his absence. Umar further says that in those days they were alarmed by a rumor that a Ghassanid king intended to invade Medina, and they were constantly agitated by it. Once, when his Ansari friend came to his house and knocked at his door asking to open, Umar inquired of his friend if the Ghassanids had attacked Medina. The Byzantine star was in the ascent in those days. Its armies had, under Heraclius, dealt a death blow to the Iranian forces and carried their arms to the capital of Iran. The glorious victory was celebrated by the emperor's stately march from Hims to Aile in the 7th year of Hijrah. Heraclius himself carried, in the guise of a pilgrim, the true cross retrieved from the Persian, while the carpets were spread and rose water sprinkled beneath his feet all over the paths by the people, who went forth to meet their hero with tears and acclamations. Hardly 2 years has passed to this event, and the victory won by the emperor of Romans when the Prophet led an army to face him. The Prophet's daring venture made such a deep impression on the minds of the Arabs that it would be no exaggeration to claim that the expedition of Tabuk served as a prelude to the conquest of Syria during the reign of Abu Bakr and Umar. The expedition of Tabuk really applied the match to train of victories which eventually made Muslims masters of Syria. What was the genesis of this expedition? It is related that the Prophet got reports of Byzantine forces converging on the northern frontiers of Arabia with the intention of mounting an attack on the Muslims. Ibn Sa'd and Waqidi are on record that the Prophet was informed by people in that area that Heraclius was, after stocking 1 year of provision for his army and drafting the pro-Byzantine tribes in the area under his banner, intending to come up upon him, and that his advance column had already reached Balqa. Even if we ignore this report, it can hardly be gainsaid that the purpose of the expedition was to strike terror into the neighboring powers which was the potential source of danger to the rising power of Islam. The Prophet intended to forewarn the Byzantinians that they should not consider the Muslims to be weak, nor should they take any action to violate their territorial sovereignty. The expedition was thus a warning sign, since one without enough strength could dare not shake one's fist at a great power or could not take the risk of descending on its borders. It is certain that all the events, that the true purpose of the expedition of Tabuk was what the revelation in this connection explained in the following words. As is said in the Quran, quote, O you who believe, fight those of the disbelievers who are near you, and let them find harshness in you, and know that Allah is with those who keep their duty unto Him. Unquote. This objective was more than achieved, as was subsequently borne out by the far-reaching consequences of the expedition. No retaliatory action was taken, nor any detachments were moved to the borders by the Byzantinians to drive back the Muslim army. The emperor, exhausted by the Persian campaigns, remained an impotent spectator to the raids of his confederate border tribes, or perhaps he thought it was fit to wait and see before taking up the gauntlet against the new rising power in the east. The pro-Byzantinian Christian tribes in northern Arabia were impressed by the first rattle of the new Arabian power. This was a great advantage accruing from the expedition of Tabuk, for it made these tribes shift their allegiance from Constantinople to Medina, which eventually led them to the acceptance of the religious aspect of the Islamic power. The expedition also went a long way to drive home the reality that the rise of Islam was not meteoric, fated to burst like a bubble, as some of the Arabs had been thinking, but it was as solid as a rock, with a great future lying ahead of it. In fact, severance of the ties between the border tribes and the Byzantine Empire was a condition precedent before they could pay attention to Islam, the new source of power and strength to them, which was taking roots and raising its head in their own homeland. The Divine Revelation 2 makes an allusion to this aspect of the expedition in a verse in Surat Al-Tawbah. Quote, nor step they any step that aggrieves the disbelievers, nor gain they from enemy again, but a good deed is recorded for them thereof. Unquote. The Battle of Mu'ta was still fresh in the minds of the Byzantinians, who had failed to humble the Muslim army in spite of their vastly superior numbers. The Muslims, on the other hand, having once measured sword with the Byzantinians, had overcome their traditional terror of the impregnable Roman armies. In short, the expedition of Tabuk was a landmark in the life of the Prophet, as well as in the onward march of Islamic mission, for it had far-reaching effects on the future course of events leading to the glorious conquests of Islam's gestating in the wombs of time, the time of the expedition. The expedition of Tabuk was undertaken in the month of Rajab on the 9th of Ayyash. It was a time when the date crop had ripened and the shade of the trees was pleasant. The Prophet undertook a long journey for the Tabuk expedition and travelled deserts and arid plains to face an enemy vastly superior in numbers. As the Muslims were then passing through a period of drought, the Prophet told the companions beforehand, unlike previous occasions, that he intended to make for the Byzantinians so that they may make suitable preparations. The hypocrites fell out on different pretexts and excuses. They either disliked the strenuous war against the powerful enemy or disliked to go out in the heat, in the temperatures at that time. They even doubted the truth and had little interest in fighting for the sake of God, so they refrained from accompanying the Prophet on this occasion. Such people were admonished by God in the following verse, quote, those who were left behind, rejoicing at sitting still behind the messenger of Allah and were averse to striving with their wealth, their lives in Allah's way, and they said, go not forth in the heat. Say to them, the heat of hell is more intense of heat, if they but understood. Unquote. enthusiasm of the Muslims. The Prophet took particular care to make preparations for the expedition. He urged upon his affluent companions to donate handsomely for the campaign, with the result that many well-to-do companions made lavish contributions. Usman bin Affan spent 1,000 dinars on the force known as the Brigade of Distress. The Prophet invoked Allah's blessings on Usman. A number of the companions were unable to raise the money for their mounts, requested the Prophet to arrange the same for them. As, however, their request could not be met for the want of funds, the Prophet expressed his inability to comply with their request, and they had to go back disheartened. Some of them were so sorrow-stricken and depressed that God sent down revelations for them from the duty and exempt them from the duty of joining the expedition. Quote, "Nor unto those is there any blame, whom when they came to you, asking that you should mount them, you did tell them, I cannot find whereupon to mount you. They turned back with eyes flowing with tears for sorrow that could not find the means to spend." Unquote. There were still others who could not make up their mind to participate in the campaign, although their indecision was not because of any doubt or misgivings. The Prophet sent out for Tabuk with an army of 30,000 strong from Medina. In no other drive earlier to Tabuk, such a large number of people had shouldered arms. Before the departure, the Prophet ordered the men to pitch their camps at a certain valley. He put Muhammad bin Maslama al-Ansari in charge of Medina and left behind Ali to look after his family. When Ali complained to the Prophet that the hypocrites were going to spread false rumors about him, he replied, "Are you not content, Ali, that you are to me as Harun was for Musa, except that there will be no Prophet after me?" When the Prophet made camp in Al-Hijr, the land of Thamud, he told the companions that it was the country of those who were being tortured for their sins. He said, "If you enter the houses of those who did wrong to themselves, enter tearfully with the fear that you may also be met with a similar fate that befell them." He also instructed his men, "Do not drink any of the water nor use it for ablution. If you have used any for dough, then feed it to the camels and eat none of it." The journey was extremely arduous. The scarcity of water added to the misery of the army. When the people complained to the Prophet about their distress, he prayed to God, and a cloud came down in torrents until every man had quenched his thirst and stored enough water to meet his needs. Some of the hypocrites kept company with the Prophet. While the Muslim army was getting along to Tabuk, one of them said to another, but alluding to the Prophet, "Do you think that the executioners of the Romans will deal with you in the same way as the Arabs do? By God, we seem to see you bound with ropes tomorrow." Yuhayna bin Rubah, the governor of Ayla, called upon the Prophet at Tabuk. Yuhanna made a treaty of peace and also paid a poll tax. So did the people of Jarba and different places, and they were all granted peace as well as guarantee for the safety of their territory and their ships and caravans by land and by sea. The treaties were gotten written by the Prophet and delivered to the parties. The Prophet received Yuhanna cordially, showing him due respect. The Byzantium did not stir. When the Prophet saw that there was no movement of the troops by the enemy, who seemed to have abandoned their border towns, he gave orders for the return march. The objective of the expedition having been achieved, the Prophet did not consider it necessary to advance further in the enemy territory to carry on the hostilities. Only a Christian chief, who was the ruler of Dumatul, Jandal, and enjoyed the patronage of the Byzantinians, was reported to be harboring hostile designs. The Prophet sent Khalid bin Walid with 500 troops, who captured this chief and brought him to the Prophet. The Prophet, however, spared his life on the condition that he surrendered unconditionally and agreed to pay poll tax. After staying for a few nights in Tabuk, the Prophet returned back to Medina. Funeral of a poor Muslim. Abdullah Zul Bijadain died at Tabuk. He had been too eager to accept Islam, but his tribesmen had prevented him from conversion. At last they turned him out with only one coarse sheet of cloth, in which he repaired to call upon the prophet. By the time he came to the prophet, the sheet of cloth had been torn into two pieces, one of which he used as a lion cloth and the other he had wrapped about around him. He was known as Zulbijadain from the day he appeared before the prophet in that condition. When he died at Tabuk, the prophet joined his burial along with Abu Bakr and Umar ibn al-Khattab. By the light of the torch held by someone, a grave was dug for him, and the prophet himself went down to lay him to rest. While Abu Bakr and Umar let down the corpse of Abdullah Zulbijadain, the prophet said to them, quote, "Bring your brother nearer to me." After the prophet had arranged Abdullah for his niche, he said, "O God, I am pleased with him. Be you pleased with him." Abdullah ibn Mas'ud used to say thereafter, "Would that I had been the man in that grave," to which the prophet said this. The trial of Ka'b ibn Malik. Some of the Muslims who had stayed behind in the expedition of Tabuk, not because of any doubt or disaffection, were Ka'b ibn Malik, Murara, and Hilal. All of them had accepted Islam in the early stages of the prophet's mission and undergone hardships for the sake of their faith. Murara and Hilal had also taken part in the Battle of Badr. Actually, none of them had ever been languid in accompanying the Prophet in previous battles, and therefore their failure to do so in the expedition of Tabuk could not have been brought about only by the will of Providence, which perhaps wanted to set another example of severe trial to test the strength of their faith for the benefit of the coming generations. They had been held back on the occasion partly on account of indolence and indecision to join the army, and partly because of their placing reliance on worldly means and objects, or perhaps that they had not given thought to the urgency of the matter as it deserved. They were common human failings which are very often let down those who have second to none in the sincerity of their faith in God and the love of the Prophet. Of a fact, this is the moral so pointedly illustrated by these words of Ka'b bin Malik. "Every day I would go out to get ready for the journey so that I may leave with them, but I would come back not having done anything. I would say to myself, I can do whatever whenever I wanted to, but continued procrastinating until the time for departure came and the Prophet left with the Muslims. And I still had not made necessary preparations. I thought that I could go after a day or two and they can join them. I went to make the preparations after they had left, but again returned without having done nothing. Day after day passed until I became sluggish while the army had gone far ahead at full speed. I still thought of leaving Medina to overtake them, and I wish I had done so, but I did not." Unquote. All the three companions were called upon to prove, in a way unknown to the annals of any religion, the sincerity of their faith in God and their love for the Prophet. It was undoubtedly an excruciating trial of their loyalty to Islam, of their perseverance and tenacity in times of ease as well as difficulty, in cheer as well as despondency. There is also not the least doubt that all these true-spirited companions spoke the truth when the hypocrites had offered excuses for justifying their absence from the expedition. The incident as related in the tradition on the authority of Ka'b ibn Malik goes on with the narrative which speaks of his sincerity. Quote, "Those who had stayed behind came and began to make excuses. With oaths, they were about 80 of them, and the Prophet accepted their excuses, administered oaths to them, and asked the divine forgiveness for them, leaving what they had concealed in their hearts to God. Then I came and saluted him, and he smiled as one who is angry. He said, 'Come nearer.' I went and sat before him. Then he asked, 'Why did you, what kept you behind? Did you not purchase a mount?' He said, 'True to God, it was exactly so. O Prophet of God, were I sitting with anyone else in the world, I would have thought of offering some excuse for saving myself from this anger, for I know how to argue for me and justify myself. But true to God, I know that I were to satisfy you by telling a lie, God will soon make you angry with me. If I displease you now by telling you the truth, I hope that God will excuse me in the end. Honest to God, I have no excuse at all, and I was never stronger or richer than when I stayed behind. The hour of trial came at last. The prophet forbade everyone to speak to three who made a clean breast. Such were those Muslims who knew nothing but to listen and obey to the prophet, that even the members of their own family would not address a word to these men. All the three felt forsaken and abandoned, as they were lonesome in an alien territory. They endured this for 50 nights. Murara, Hilal shut themselves up in their houses, lamenting and shedding tears all the while. Kaab was, however, young and sturdy. He used to go out and join the prayers with the others, roamed about in the markets, but nobody seemed willing to keep company or talk to him. But the aloofness did not cause to increase the distance between them and the prophet, for was there any diminution in the loving regard that the prophet had for them? The admonition by the prophet rather gave rise to a still acuter longing in them to regain the affection of the prophet. The narration of Ka'b bin Malik, which bears freshness of the plain truth, goes on to say, quote, "And I would go to the prophet and salute him when he sat with others after the prayers, thinking whether his lips had moved in returning my salutation or not. Then I would pray near him and see him with half an eye. I marked that he fastened his eyes on me when I was busy in prayers, but he turned away from me as soon as I tried to look at him." The wide world seemed to have closed in on these men. Ka'b bin Malik relates that the behavior of one of whom he considered to be an inseparable friend. Quote, "When the harshness of the people became unbearable, I scaled the wall of Abu Qatada's orchid and went to meet him. He was my cousin and held the dearest to me. I greeted him, but by God, he did not return my salutation. I said, 'O Abu Qatada, I adjure you by God, do you not know I love God and his prophet?' But he still kept quiet, so I repeated my question. He again remained silent for a while and then said, 'God and his prophet know the best.' At that, my eyes gave way to tears. I jumped over the wall and I went back." The ordeal, however, did not come close at that. The ban was extended to their wives, and the three were ordered to separate themselves from their wives, though without divorcing them. All of them obediently yielded to the command. The faith and loyalty and firmness of Ka'b bin Malik was brought to yet more delicate and crucial test when the king of Ghassan tried to angle him with a silver hook. He was the ruler of a kingdom who had exercised a deep influence upon the Arabs. The Arab nobles and chieftains vied with one another to enter the circle of his entourage, or even to be invited to attend his court. The eminent poets composed splendid eulogies in the honor of the Ghassanid kings. The courtiers of the king contacted Ka'b bin Malik when the prophet's aloofness and the coolness to the people to him had been agonizing enough to drive him crazy. The courier delivered him a letter of the king in which he had written, "We have learnt that your master has treated you badly. God has not destined you to be humiliated and wasted. So come to us and we shall deal kindly with you." Ka'b took the letter to be a challenge to his integrity. His conscience smote him to the point of tantalizing his love for God and his prophet. And so he took the letter to an oven and burnt it. Their test was over at last. None of them, of the three, was found wanting. They came the revelation from God, which illustrated their personal example to make it a general lesson, good for all times to come. They had demonstrated by their action that they could not flee from God, but could only find solace and refuge in coming back to God. The spacious earth of God had become straitened for them. Rather, in their own souls, they had a feeling of constraint, but they did not falter from the right path. Then it was that God forgave them and took them back to God's grace. But a noteworthy feature of the verses revealed on this occasion was that the Most Gracious God did not make a mention of the repentance of these three people, only except they might feel singled out and humiliated. Their penitence was spoken of after mentioning the contribution of the Prophet and the Ansar and the Muhajirin, who had been ready and willing to take part in the expedition. The revelation goes to show that whatever suffering and hardship they had endured had raised their degree in their spiritual world. Quote, Allah has turned in mercy to the Prophet and to the Muhajirin and the Ansar who followed him in the hour of hardship. After the hearts of a party of them had almost severed aside, they turned He unto them in mercy. He is full of pity and merciful to them. And to the three also did He turn in mercy, who were left behind when the earth, vast as it was straitened for them, and their own souls were straitened for them, till they brought them that there is no refuge from Allah except towards Allah. Then He turned unto them in mercy, that they too might turn repentant unto Him. Lo, Allah is relenting, the most merciful. The expedition at a glance. The expedition of Tabuk, which took place in the month of Rajab, 9 AH, was the last campaign during the lifetime of the Prophet. The number of his battles was 27, while he is reported to have sent out 60 forays and expeditions, although no fighting had taken place in many of them. Never in the history of human conflict had any conqueror shed so little blood and was crowned with such remarkable success. In all of these battles, only 1,118 people, Muslims as well as non-Muslims, lost their lives. But it would be to attempt the impossible to hazard any guess as to how much blood of the ferocious Arabs was saved from being spilled, or how many souls escaped degradation and debasement because of this negligible loss of human life. Such was the public tranquility and orderliness resulting from the Prophet's campaign that a woman pilgrim would go from Hira to Mecca and return after circumventing the Kaaba without any fear in her heart except that of God. Another report says that women from Qadesiya went alone on their pilgrimage to Mecca without the least anxiety or fear. This was the country in which, from the time immemorial, fights, battles between nomadic tribes, raids on one another's flock and property had been accepted unquestionably as a part of desert life. Even the caravans of neighboring powerful kingdoms dared not cross the country in pre-Islamic days without powerful escorts and guides. The campaign of the Prophet were warranted by two universal truths enunciated in the Quran. One of these says that persecution is worse than slaughter, and the other declares that there is life for you in retaliation, O men of understanding. These twin principles, which aimed at refusal to acquiesce in wrongdoing and urge to strive for the defense of honor and justice, over soon established peace and order at the cost of minimum labor and time on part of the Muslims under the benevolent and altruistic guidance of the Prophet, who was ever vigilant to secure the well-being and enlightenment of the enemy instead of allowing the satisfaction of vindicative feelings to become the objective of his campaign. Whenever the Prophet sent out a detachment for forays or gave battle to the enemies, he invariably issued strict instructions to his men to be fearing of God and kind to the friends as well as to the foes. The directions one he gave to his troops were as follows. Quote, I ask you to fear God and to be considerate to the Muslims with you. Fight in the name of God and slay those in his name who have disbelieved him. Neither should you break your promise, nor pilfer the spoils, nor kill any child or woman or man in form and old, or a priest who has withdrawn to seclusion. Never lay your hands on date palms, nor chop down a tree, nor yet pull down any building. Unquote. And how successful were these campaigns of the Prophet can be judged from the fact that within a brief period of 10 years, more than 1 million square miles was won for Islam. The Islamic State expanded at an average rate of 274 miles daily at the cost of one martyr a month. This respect for human blood is unequaled in the annals of mankind. The truth of this assertion is amply borne out if the losses of these campaigns were placed by the side of casualties in the last two world wars, first of which was fought from 1914 to 1918 and the second 1939 to 1945. According to the computations of Encyclopedia Britannica, 64,000 people lost their lives in the First World War, and the number of casualties in the Second ranged from 35 to 60 million. Yet, none of these two bloodstained wars can be claimed to have done any good to humanity, nor did they solve any problems of the world. The tribunals known as the Inquisitions established by the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle Ages for the trials and punishments of heretics were reported to have taken a toll of 12 million lives as well. The first Hajj, the pilgrimage, was enjoined in 9 AH. The Prophet sent Abu Bakr in command of the pilgrims. The polytheists were, during the year, at their pilgrimage stations. Abu Bakr led a party of 100 Muslims. The opening verses of Surah Tawba were revealed after the pilgrims had left for Mecca. The Prophet sent for Ali and charged him to proclaim the verses at Mina when all the pilgrims had assembled there after performing the sacrifice. It signified the end of idolatry in Arabia, for no idolater was allowed to perform the Hajj nor go around the Kaaba in a nude state after that year. The divine revelations also laid down that if the Prophet was obliged to fulfill any obligation under a treaty with the polytheists, it would be discouraged up to the stipulated period, after which the compact would have to be deemed dissolved. Ali went forth to the Prophet's camel and overtook Abu Bakr in the way, who asked Ali if he had come to give orders to him or to convey orders. Ali replied that he only had been charged to convey orders. Thereafter, both went to Mecca, where Abu Bakr managed the arrangements for Hajj. When the day of sacrifice came, Ali proclaimed that he had been ordered so and so by the Prophet. Jazakallah khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.